Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Ann Perry has two best-selling series, one featuring Inspector Thomas Pitt and the other starring Inspector William Monk and his competent and caring wife, Hester. The books in both series are thought-provoking, atmospheric thrillers, which include plot lines that ask soul-searching questions about the moral and ethical values of society both yesterday and today. In her latest, Blind Justice, she exposes the vulnerabilities of organized religion, the precarious boundaries of justice, and the flaws within the legal system. It's a great pleasure to welcome Ann Perry to this week's book show. Thank you so much for being with us. What a delight.
Thank you, and thank you for such an excellent and perceptive introduction.
I have been a huge fan of your work for so long, and it is so it's a delight to speak to you. And to get an idea of what brought you to this particular time period and to say, this is going to be my milieu and I'm going to stick with it.
I stick with it in that I return to it, but I do work in several other time periods as well. World War One, medieval Byzantium, other times and places that are interesting. But this, I've grown very fond of the people, and this particular time is sufficiently close to our own that we can understand it and it can mirror our own very immediately. But it's still far enough away to be a glamorous journey.
What is it about that closeness? Because it is a few generations removed, and yet we still feel as though it's very relevant because those problems and those questions are still very much with us and
they
always
are,
will be.
Aren't they? We haven't solved any of those emotional problems yet. And the moral difficulties still reflect our own. I get my plot ideas actually from today's headlines.
So give us an example of a headline that would have influenced this book.
Some of the preachers who require, they always seem to be asking for money. And we don't know what they do with the money. And then they make a mistake and it's all public confession and so forth. But still the bottom line is, please give me money. And I have been asked for money because people think that I am comfortably off. And the emotional extortion that goes with it. And I think you have to be quite strong to say, look, I'm sorry, but I am accountable for what I do with my money. You are not. You don't know what other commitments I have. Now back off. Many people, especially if you live with and attend every Sunday the particular group that's asking you for money, they can make life very uncomfortable for you if you don't give. And I think that's moral extortion.
And it seems as though in the novel the real trouble is that it's because it's in the name of God.
Exactly. It's, you know, if you are good and if you are just and you love Jesus or whatever particular religion they're using, then you will give me. And most people don't have the confidence, because they always look, when they know who to direct their attentions to, say, look, I already am committed. You're going to put me into debt. Is that what you wish to do? And if so, why? But we don't think of that answer at the time. We can be embarrassed, humiliated into doing things. And then, of course, there's Rathbone's deep, deep dilemma. He wants to save passionately, he wants to save the people who are being publicly humiliated. He wants to see this miserable man put out of business. But to do that, the only way within his grasp is to do something that is also very questionable. And he might pay a very high price for it personally if he does. But can he sit by and let injustice pass, even if he might have to pay a high price to sort it?
This is, as I mentioned, a William Monk novel. At what point do you decide that headline will be right for this character or that character?
It more or less comes equipped, because this is a very dark side of legal decision-making. Rathbone is newly a judge, of which he's very proud, and yet he has to do something that compromises his legal position if he does and his moral position if he doesn't. Now, I couldn't put that into a pit.
And the fact that Hester plays such a role in this story.
She would, wouldn't she?
Yes. But which is wonderful. And I would think that's the fun part.
Yes, that and Scuff being taken to church for the first time. And children are marvelous for asking you the questions that put you right on the spot.
To get you to that.
Yes, they don't
that
do
eternal
truth. Yes,
that,
they
that,
don't do it intentionally. But, well, I apparently when I was very small, I said to my mother, well, if God made the world, what did he stand on when he was making it?
Hmm.
Seems reasonable to me at the time.
Still a good question now, yes, actually, yes. I must say. And does it come from when dealing with a subject like religion, do you have to become yourself attached from your beliefs, or are they very much a part of the equation in the writing?
I think my beliefs are always just part of who I am.
Mm.
But because I am a religious person, my church does not do this to me, but I have members of it who have tried this sort of thing, saying, look, you know, you're reasonably comfortable. They have no idea what commitments I have. You should do this. If you love the Lord will recompense you for it. Now, that is not the right way to treat people. But we tend to use any manipulation we can. It's a tendency in us from the time we're very little, unless you're taught this is not an acceptable way to do it.
And then to bring these characters into looking at this decision, looking at this as an issue, as a moral dilemma, and then to bring the crime aspect and to make it,
that's what's fun,
a wonderful mystery.
That's what's fun. And to put to Rathbone, who has been just a little bit judgmental, to put him completely on the wrong foot and have him end up actually in prison himself,
mm,
and being the one who is accused and cannot speak.
And that the helplessness of not being, yes, able to speak.
Suddenly he's in the other chair.
Which is foreign,
yes,
but also very scary.
Yes, scare the so-and-so out of him. Well, you know, I keep getting told by my American agent as well as by my British agent, ratchet up the tension. Whatever situation is bad, make it worse. And why not? Let's go for broke.
The time that you spend in the novel in the courtroom is so exciting and so
It's fun to write. It's such fun to write.
So
that's dialogue at its sharpest.
And you have to be on top of it. And I assume that is from spending a lot of time in a courtroom.
It isn't. I've never been in a Victorian courtroom.
That is wonderful. But as far as...
I love watching legal shows, though. I think, really, our courtroom scenes are dramatized considerably. I think if you were to sit in an ordinary courtroom, you might find it was simply tragic.
Right. And procedural.
Yes, I don't think that's what we expect when we read something. If you listen to most conversation, there are lots of ums and ers and ahs. You take out the repetitions and the ers when you're writing dialogue. Many people repeat themselves.
Mm.
We have to make it readable, as well as it's a compromise between dramatic, readable, and natural.
And it becomes wonderfully, the dialogue is, for want of a better term, snappy.
I hope so.
Yes. In the creation of these characters, of all the characters in this book, and of course in the other series, has it surprised you of how they take on a life of their own?
It did to begin with. I'm kind of used to it now.
Hmm.
I've just created a new little character for once written, but it isn't printed yet, a little friend for Scuff, and his name is Worm. Now, as soon as I got his name, I knew what he was going to be like. He's a much, much younger child, another little urchin, but sharp, a survivor. When you've got somebody's name or the salient feature about them, they begin to be real in your mind. Then you give them something to say, and every time they do something or say something, their character becomes more defined. I mean, once he said, I love nuts, for example, then you bring nuts in. Every time he says, oh, I hate such and such, then it's going to recur again. The more you build, the more there is to build on.
Of course, you have the series. You also have a wonderful tradition of writing holiday stories as well.
Well, I take minor characters from from the Pit and Monk. I haven't ever taken them from the war stories yet, and maybe I won't, I don't know. But I take some of the minor characters and make them a major player. In the one I've just finished, which can't be this Christmas, it must be next Christmas. Must be, I think. It's Pitt's daughter Jemima, and she comes to New York.
Hmm. And you get to write about New York. You get to write about this character that you wouldn't spend
as much
time with.
She's not a little girl. She's now about 23, and she solves the crime.
What is it about those? Because they're slight. They're not as long, and yet
150 pages roughly.
And yet they're. I would assume they're almost an excursion.
Yes, but
off the regular journey.
Yes, but they should still have a powerful message. It's Christmas after all.
Hmm.
You should have something about reconciliation, redemption, hope, something that's a good message for Christmas.
And those are topics that you confront regularly in your novels.
Yeah, yes, I do. I care about them a lot.
Do you have faith that we as readers share those?
Oh, yes, indeed. Particularly Americans. I get lovely letters from people, which is the greatest reward because it's the one thing nobody can ever take away from you. Not even the tax man can take those from you. You can't say I'll have 10% or 20% or 40% of that lovely letter you just got.
And they come in what variety? In the sense of saying what to you to give you...
The letters?
Yes.
Oh, that they have now, the war stories particularly, people have said, I never understood why my father, grandfather, uncle wouldn't speak about these things. Now I feel as if I understand him and I feel closer to him. Sometimes I get stories or letters, I understand this or that emotion. I feel more hopeful. I would like to be like Hester. Hester seems to be the one that people want to be like.
Oh, I'd like to be like Hester.
Yeah.
And
I suppose for her courage and integrity, I'd like to be like her.
but again, a part of you is very much a part of her, right?
Yeah, I wish to be one. Yes.
And that is the wonderful part of these characters is they're so rich. They have wonderful names.
The name is terribly important. When you've got a person's name right, you can begin to get the rest of them. Wrong name and they just never get off the page. I've had characters who didn't work, change their name, and suddenly they're all right. I know what they're going to say, what they care about, how they're going to dress, what they want.
And you seem better than that than most Americans.
Do I?
Yes. I think the British are wonderful in coming up with, I mean, starting with Dickens, of course.
Yes. I don't make mine as onomatopoeic or as appropriate to character as he does. And I just go through, not a telephone book, because I live in the north of Scotland, then half of them be Max, but a gazetteer of place names for surnames. And I get name books for Christian names and maybe just alter them around a little bit. I mean, one of my favourite characters of all, the one I really would like to be, is Vespasia. But that's just simply the Emperor Vespasian with the N knocked off the end.
Hmm. But let's get back to Worm.
Yes.
And that's great, isn't it?
Well, his name just came when I sort of saw him in my mind.
Hmm.
And Scuff.
What is that process like when you have a character that comes to you, almost fully formed?
It's like discovering a new beautiful plant in the garden. It was probably there for a while, but suddenly you look at it and you think, I really can do something with this. It's here. Like making a new friend. And sometimes you can know somebody for years or be acquainted with them but not really know them. And then you might meet somebody else and within half an hour you've touched minds.
And do you make a conscious decision that maybe at some point I will get to know that person better?
No, it just either happens or it doesn't. Sometimes I think Vespasia was meant to be a walk-on, walk-off.
Mm-hmm.
And she walked on in about the third or fourth book, and the 29th, 30th, she's still here, getting more and more important. There are other characters that walked on and were supposed to be major, and I realize I've written three chapters and not mentioned them. They didn't work.
And is it internal of knowing that it doesn't work?
Well, when it doesn't work, I realize that I have written three chapters and I haven't mentioned them because I forgot them. Because they weren't alive to me. And if they're not alive to me, they certainly won't be to you.
And when you get the mail and when you get the reaction from people about certain characters. Does that play a role in how you utilize them in
yes.
the future?
If somebody really likes someone, I will remember and I will feel good about it. Mm-hmm. And then I will try to use that person more.
And over the years, you have this incredible stable of characters now.
Well, sometimes you bring somebody in for a small part, and you like them so much, you want to bring them back again and again. They start off as incidental and end up as absolutely major.
When you think of what you do as far as writing novels, writing crime novels, mystery novels, especially tackling many of the subjects that you tackle, is there the primary goal, I assume, is to entertain the audience?
No, it's to make them think and feel.
Okay.
And you do that through entertaining them. If you don't entertain them, you won't hold them.
But many authors will say it's the other way around. I'm interested in entertaining, and then if there's a message with that.
No, my theme comes first. This is burning a hole in me. I've got to say it.
Mm-hmm.
And the best example I can give of that is probably the war stories, which took me 7 years altogether from conception through to writing the last of the five of them. And I still feel passionately about the theme, which is that sometimes life is so absolutely terrible, beyond belief, awful, that you feel as if there is nothing you can do, you're helpless. And my main character is a chaplain, and he can't say to them, I'll save you. He can't say, I'll save your arms or your legs or your friends or even we'll win. There's only one thing he can say, and this applies to all terrible situations. I will not leave you.
Mm.
I can remember hearing about, from a man, the man himself, I don't know what happened to his wife. I think she just couldn't cope with it. His only child, son, took his own life.
Mm.
What do you say to somebody? It'll be all right. He's gone to heaven. Nothing you can say. But his minister came and sat with him every evening. Didn't say anything, just was there for him. And then every other evening, and then twice a week, and then once a week. Just, I won't leave you. And sometimes when things are unspeakably awful, the only thing you can do is hold out a hand in the night and take the other person's hand and say, I won't leave you. You're not alone. And Joseph, as a chaplain in the trenches, that was all he could do. And his whole vindication for his entire service throughout the four and a half years of the war, were when he came back to the front lines at the very, very end, and the last silence fell, he'd had to go back to London to tie up the mysteries and all the rest of it. And one of the young men looked at him from his regiment and said, I knew you'd come back. I knew you wouldn't leave us.
Mm.
And that, I think, is what faith is. I knew you wouldn't leave me.
And in the writing of that story, that baseline of faith, I assume, was with you every day in the writing. You never lose that.
Yes. No. I think when Christ was in Gethsemane and said, watch with me, that's the basic commandment of everything. Or plea, watch with me. And that's what we should be doing. That's what a minister is there for. I'll not leave you.
Mm.
And that still practically reduces me to tears. And it's ages since I first started. But in each story, I have or should have a theme, something I'm trying to say. And the story should say that powerfully.
And in this...
Make you care. Not just know, but care.
And in Blind Justice, it's the fact that even though you have faith, you may be misled.
Yes, or you may not be able to sort it out without a very high price yourself. Do you step back and say, I'm not prepared to pay that price? The injustice will just have to go on, and this person will drown in front of me emotionally and financially. Or I will step in, even if it compromises me. And I mean, it's a terribly difficult decision. If it were easy, it wouldn't be worth asking the question.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether Rathbone did the right thing or the wrong thing. He's a better man for it at the end, I know that.
And are you a better person and a better writer for exploring it?
I hope so. But I had to explore it. Because I think that sometimes it's not easy to decide what to do. Very often it's not easy to know what is right.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're prepared to pay that cost of maybe compromising yourself, or you're going to keep your clothes clean, and if the other person drowns, well, tough. Does that not also compromise you?
I asked a variation of this question earlier, but Do you feel that there's a lack of faith, that we are somewhat bereft in faith in our modern world?
Yes. But there are other people who have wonderful faith. And yes, we are bereft of faith, but I think we've always been many people who are bereft of faith, and it comes and it goes. We most of us have a dark night of the soul at some time or another. But it's not terribly fashionable to say that you believe. But if you do, you'll find other people come up to you and say, I'm glad to hear you say that.
And no matter what the belief is, why do you think it has become so difficult? Is it for many of the reasons that we've just talked about, that often the message is corrupted?
Well, yes. And also, there's a great deal of, I can't hear what you say because what you do speaks so loud, or what you don't do.
Mm-hmm.
Each person has to find their own strength. And something that comforts me a lot, because these days we do know a great deal of unspeakable things that go on. I mean, look at what's happening in Syria.
Sure.
It's absolutely a nightmare. But I've written a couple of fantasies. And in one, they're translating a book of conversation between God and Satan. And one of the lesser characters says to the main character, couldn't we just soften this a little bit? Because we're making this hell is so dreadful. And she says, yes, we could. We could make hell less deep. But if we do that, we also make heaven less high. Do you want that? No. No, thank you.
The characters in this book of being able to discuss this and still have, because these are very heavy themes, and yet there is still very much a breeziness and a quality of the books that is beautiful.
Thank you. I hope so. I don't believe life's a and then you die. I have traveled the United States. I've been to 36 different states now, and I've met with kindness in every one of them.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of good people around. I was listening just a couple of evenings ago to people talking, an older gentleman who'd done well, retired, talking about helping, mentoring teenagers who were in trouble, putting their time and their care to being there all the time to help these young people. Not anybody they knew. People even of different race, different basic nationality, come to America. Just giving of themselves and time and care. There are a lot of good people. It's not news the way the unpleasant things are.
Do you feel that there is an importance to the message of the novels?
I suppose I must do it. I wouldn't be caring about it, would I?
Hmm.
That's a question to which there's no good answer, because if I say yes, I sound terribly self-important. And if I say no, then you say, well, why are you bothering writing them? Yes, I care. Of course I care.
Yes. Well, I like that answer better. Then in the sense of, because a lot of people, as I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. will say, if the reader comes out happy, if the reader, I'm writing for that reader. And if they're entertained, then I'm good.
But good storytelling does entertain.
Sure.
I mean, you sugarcoat the pill, I suppose, but yes, I want to entertain, I want to draw you in, I want to make you think, laugh occasionally, maybe cry, but above all, care.
Mm.
That's what I want when I read somebody's book. I want to be made to think and say, hadn't thought of that. Yes.
And that's what's wonderful about these characters, is they are so, you want them to be around.
Thank you. Well, they will be for a little while. At least, as long as I'm alive and well and somebody wants to know, somebody wants to read some more, there'll be more.
Well, that's good to know. Ann Perry is the author of Blind Justice. It is a William Monk novel. It is published by Ballantine Books. What a great pleasure. Thank you so much for spending time
Thank
with
you.
Us.
Thank you. I appreciate pleasure. You coming for me. That was lovely.
Thank you. The new book is Blind Justice. It is published by Ballantine. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke and Katie Britton produced our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.